Good afternoon, everybody. We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is now 1:05 p.m. Wednesday, February 16th, 2022. Here with us today, giving us a quorum is Representative Schrage, Representative Gillen, Representative Hannon, Representative Rauscher, myself, Representative Putkudup, Representative Hopkins, Representative Kronk, Representative Fields, and Representative McKay. If I can remind folks to please silence your cell phones. On today's docket, we have House Bill 209, which is Emergency Firefighters, by our very own Representative Kronk. We're also going to pick back up where we left off on House Bill 52, which is the Tutka Bay Hatcheries, by Representative Vance. And hopefully we'll be able to get to House Bill 287 in our allotted time, which is Representative Rauscher's Oil and Gas Tax Credit Fund appropriation. Going right into House Bill 209, this is our first hearing on the bill. We'll have Rep. Kronk and his staff introduce the bill. We'll go through kind of initial questions on the synopsis, and then we'll hear from the Department of Natural Resources on their comments on the bill. So, Representative Kronk, if you could please take the testifier's table and begin your presentation.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have my staff's shoe with me here. HB 209 is an act relating to emergency firefighters. HB 209 authorizes the commission.
Representative Kronk, please put your name on the record.
Oh, sorry. Resident Mike Kronk, District 6, serving a very large part of Alaska. Thank you. HB 209, an act relating to emergency firefighters. HB 209 authorizes the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to hire emergency firefighter personnel using general fund appropriations. By amending AS 41.15.030B, allowing the use of general funds to pay EFF personnel, they would be able to perform non-emergency work such as hazardous fuel reductions, fuel break development, fire prevention, habitat restoration, or improvements, activities in fire-prone areas. In addition, this would provide economic opportunities for Alaskans to enhance public safety, to empower rural Alaskans, to responsibly manage the state's natural resources, and to protect and save human lives. Such non-emergency work would reduce the likelihood, intensity, and damage of wildland fires near populated areas and could bring significant reductions in the state's cost to fight future fires. Steady employment opportunities for mostly rural-based firefighting crews would strengthen local economies, family life, and enhance public safety. By employing EFF during non-emergency, it would provide training, fitness, and readiness for when wildfire does occur. The number of EFF personnel may be interested in applying for permanent DNR jobs would increase, which would help with recruitment of those jobs. So, if we have any questions.
Any initial questions from committee members before we pivot over to Fire Aviation Chief and our special projects folks? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Kronk, you've used the phrase a couple times, general funds, and I'm curious whether the statute, because I'm thinking of things like it might be a municipality that's doing fire breaks, and is there currently in statute a specific prohibition, and that's why you're focusing on general funds? Because as I'm thinking about it, BLM monies, the reimbursement for fire certainly could be used already, and whether general funds is a significant element of that, or just because it's the
Through the chair, Sue Stancliffe, for the record, Sue Stancliffe, rep, staff to Representative Kronk. Currently, the statute does prohibit general funds to be used for hiring non-emergency firefighters, and this would amend that, allowing it to be used for that.
Okay, and one follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Hannah.
Are there any other funds that are currently restricted from being used that would want to encapsulate, make sure, so, designated federal receipts, interagency receipts, or is general funds the only prohibition?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, for state EFF, just, state, We don't have general funds. There are no other funds used unless there is an incident. Once there is an incident, depending on the land ownership, if it's on BLM, then it's federal. If it is within a municipality, if it is perhaps tribal land or something to that effect, then the landowner pays and contributes to those fees. But this is strictly general fund. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Hannah. Representative Rocha?
Yeah, thank you very much, the Chair, Representative Crump. I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I have a lot of friends that are firefighters, and I know an extreme amount about their cause here. So I do want to thank you. First off, I just want to ask you a question. You have a letter here from Commissioner Feige that you set before us. Does that mean the department is in favor of this also, or is this personal?
And Representative Rocher, I know that we're going to have DNR speak to their thoughts on the bill, but if the representative or staff would like to comment, feel free to.
Through the chair, Representative Rocher, could you please ask, what were you asking exactly?
That's okay. I can wait for the commissioner then, the way you explained it to me. I didn't know the commissioner was going to speak here today.
So. The department will speak, not
okay,
necessarily.
Okay, then I'll hold my question for the department. Thank you very much for this bill.
Okay, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward when this issue came to light. I think it was last year working together. I was glad you introduced this. Thank you. My question, I have two-part questions. My understanding is that we cannot use federal money to maintain fire breaks around the state. We can only use state money to maintain it, but we can use federal dollars to put in those fire breaks. While the Department of, or Division of Forestry has been working with local contractors and private contractors to put in a lot of those fire breaks, would these wildland firefighters be able to work on projects that do have federal dollars attached to them to put in the fire breaks initially with the language in the bill that you have?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, they would be able to do that. And the department can elaborate on that a bit, but yes, they would be able to be utilized on different fire breaks, different mitigation, regardless of the land use. And if there is an MOA in place, they would be able to use state EFF to do that, is my understanding.
Okay, thank you. I'll ask the department that. But I just want to make sure that it's not what type of land it is, but it's also what type of dollars are being used to do those non-emergency work that will be allowing them to do it. My second question that I actually had, this statute went in back in the 70s, disallowing emergency firefighters from being able to do non-emergency firefighter work.
Sure.
Did you ever find out why that language went in and what the reason for that was way back in the day?
Yes, through the chair, Representative. I put in the sponsor statement as well a brief statement of that history. I believe it was twofold. The primary one was relating to the employees, and if I may, I'll read this into the record. And based on the legislative history, the amending AS 4115030B last sentence does not appear to yield any constitutional or legal problems. In 1996, the legislature added the last sentence of AS 15050030B to address concerns about conflicts in 3925195 of the Personnel Act, the Alaska Personnel Act. Specifically, the short-term non-perm employees would become full-time employees. However, in 2000, the legislature amended 3925195 to allow for long-term non-perm employees. Due to that amendment, the apparent concerns expressed in the legislature in 1996 warranting the inclusion of the last sentence no longer exists. So, that was a part of it. The other part of it, as my personal history with the fire crews and the state budget, was the use of general funds and running short on monies. And, you know, as we tightened our belt back in the 90s and such, was to identify specifically with fire costs of fire to rein it in, if you will.
I appreciate that. Thanks. And I guess I had the 70s and the 90s mixed up, so not too far of a Wayback Machine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Representative Gillum?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cronk, I'm just curious, is there a fiscal note on this, or am I missing that?
Through the chair, Representative Gillum, there is a fiscal note, and I probably better if the department explains what the zero fiscal note is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fields?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, first wanted to say thanks. This bill is great on a lot of fronts. We've heard about the challenges in recruiting and maybe a paradigm shift where we don't have the same sort of ability to do seasonal hire, and this bill would fix that, so I think that's great. You know, in my region, certainly tree and brush lines are rising, and I think this bill kind of responds to that reality. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is in a lot of places on the hillside where we have significant fire risk and acreage, trails are fire breaks, trails are a public safety amenity in terms of fire crews getting out on a fire in the wildland-urban interface. And it's kind of interesting because crews that are doing work, say in a corridor like Rabbit Creek, are going to be preventing a fire from moving, say, up and down the canyon. And that's something where it's going to be interesting to see what ability we can have to tap some more of these federal dollars and save lives and keep fires smaller. So that's something where I'm kind of curious, and I don't expect y'all to have the answer now, but the fact that these trails are fire breaks, and we're just going to need more of them as the summers get longer and hotter and the brush lines rise. You know, how much is this going to improve our ability to capture some of these federal dollars? So that just seems like a great area of promise, and I'm sure the department will figure it out. So really just wanted to thank you and make that observation about what's going on in our backyard and acreage.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Any other questions in regards to the sponsor and sponsor statement? Seeing or hearing none, Representative Cronk, is there anything you'd like to say before we pivot over to DNR?
thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this is a long overdue bill. You know, back in the 90s when I was firefighting, there was about 70-plus crews across, the Alaskan villages, and now it's down to like 20 crews. And I'm hoping that, you know, working with, you know, the department, we're gonna get some more employment in the villages, and exactly what Rep. Field says, hopefully some more interagency, you know, partnerships of being able to use these people and do good work for Alaska, but more importantly, get them employed and keep our money in our state. I think that's one of the things I really want to focus on. We spent a lot of money of bringing crews up from the lower 48, and let's keep our money here and use our people. They're our resource.
Thank you, Representative Cronk. I believe on the line we've got Norm McDonald. Norm, the floor is yours.
All right, thank you, Dio. Have you got me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
All righty, very good. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the House Resource Committee. For the record, my name is Norm McDonald. I'm the Chief of Fire and Aviation for the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to speak to you today about the Division of Forestry's support of House Bill 209. This bill is a manifestation of Alaska's need to build capacity and face a rapidly increasing wildland fire challenge. House Bill 209 will help the division achieve our mission of fire prevention and suppression, providing safety to Alaskans statewide. This bill also provides jobs and training for Alaskans, primarily those in rural communities throughout fire-prone areas of the state. As Representative Cronk explained, removing the funding impediment in Alaska Statute 41.15.030 would allow DNR to use already allocated general funds to pay EFF for non-emergency fire prevention work during periods of low fire activity and shoulder seasons, both spring and fall. This will have two major benefits. First is the non-emergency fire prevention work. For example, cutting trees and creating fuel breaks will provide a training ground for our EFF employees to learn valuable firefighting skills and will create a consistent and desirable jobs for rural Alaskans. Second is we'll be able to leverage this workforce to drastically improve our ability to put in fuel breaks around communities to moderate wildland fires should they occur, saving potentially tens of millions of dollars in fire suppression costs down the line. So please note, while this bill allows general funds to be used for EFF and non-emergency tasks, we are suggesting only use funds that have already been appropriated for fuels reduction and prevention work, thus the zero fiscal note. In the last 2 years, DOF has received $17 million in hazard fuels reduction funds from the state, and we continue to receive more federal funds. EFF work will continue to be limited to fire response and fire prevention-related activities. DOF's firefighting mission has increased dramatically as Alaska and the nation face more intense and longer fire seasons, threatening more Alaskans and our homes and property as more of us move into the wildland interface and fire-prone fuel types. The Division of Forestry program has two primary missions. One is protecting Alaskans from wildland fire, and two is building hazardous fuel breaks around our communities to protect homes and businesses. DOF currently does not have sufficient personnel to staff to what we call preparedness level 3, a normal high fire danger day in Alaska. In the past, EFF crews supplemented our permanent and private sector workforce, and the lack of consistent EFF crews, however, has led to a drastic decline in their number. So from approximately 56 crews in 2010 to under 8 in 2021. We have particularly lost crews based in rural villages. The division now is critically understaffed, and we rely on importing lower 48 crews to replace these important EFF resources. There are several problems with substituting EFF crews with imported resources. One is the lower 48 crews are not readily available. Alaska competes with every other state for these crews, and during times of high fire activity in the lower 48, we are not always able to receive help. Response times can be as long as 72 hours, as lower 48 crews must be flown to Alaska, outfitted, and then deployed to an incident. Instead, quick, aggressive initial attack with local forces helps limit fire size and duration, reducing overall costs. The cost to import firefighters and support staff far exceeds using Alaska resources. On a fire assignment, a 22-person Alaska crew costs roughly $6,500 a day. And in return, a 22-person lower 48 crew costs nearly twice that at $13,500 a day. Lower 48 crews are not familiar with Alaskan fuel types and fire behavior. Our Alaskan crews are better able to fight our fires because they know the most effective tactics for our landscapes. This local knowledge provides a higher level of safety to the public, as well as saving suppression costs. Rebuilding our EFF crews will help create self-sufficient Alaskan firefighting force that does not rely solely on importing expensive and often unavailable lower 48 crews. It will reduce the likelihood, intensity, and damage of wildland fires near populated areas and could bring significant reductions to state's cost of fighting future fires. The second important piece of our mission is the fuels mitigation, which is the division's proactive fire prevention program. The hazardous fuels treatments around communities reduce fire risk. They are a cost-effective and efficient method of fighting fire. Currently, the division has 16 projects underway. Five more are planned for 2022, and 16 more projects are in the planning stages for 2023 through 2025. We need more resources for our fuels projects. These projects and the funding associated with them give us an opportunity to hire rural Alaskan crews on fuels projects, and when a fire starts, they will be trained and ready to deploy to fires. House Bill 209 gives the division a way to provide secure and stable jobs for rural Alaskans, which will assist both in recruitment and retention of our wildland firefighting force. Where EFF resources will most benefit is in our rural communities, where access to contracted resources, heavy equipment, and traditional fuels reduction workforce is limited. Rural or village EFF crews will provide valuable resources in protecting their communities from wildland fire. Without these EFF crews, our rural communities may not receive the same levels of protection as roadside communities. House Bill 209 also dovetails perfectly with the division's request in the governor's budget to reinstate the Wildland Fire Academy. The academy budget was cut in 2016, so reinstating this will provide a career training and jobs for new firefighters and support staff in rural and urban Alaska. We have found that workforce development is the key to building back Alaska's wildland firefighting capacity. Training firefighters in rural communities will help build our pool of recruits to work on fuels projects and for fire suppression. So in closing, House Bill 209 will provide steady employment opportunities for rural-based firefighting crews. It will strengthen local economies and enhance public safety, not only in Alaska, but in the lower 48, as EFF crews can also be deployed to fires at the national level. Increasing the number of EFF crews will also increase the number of qualified applicants for permanent DNR positions, which assists in our recruitment and retention issue. This bill aligns with the DOF, with DOF's integrated plan to enhance public safety, create a sustainable workforce, and promote economic opportunities. I want to thank you for the opportunity to voice our support for House Bill 209. I'll be available to answer questions if needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. We'll hear from Allison Arians with the Division of Forestry before we open it up for general questions. Allison, if you could please put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Allison Arians. I'm a Special Projects Coordinator with the Department of Natural Resources Division of Forestry. Mr. Kerr, I'm available for any questions you might have specifically about the fiscal note. So I can address a question that I believe
Representative Gillum had.
Gillum, Representative Gillum, would you like me to answer that now?
Yes, please.
Okay. So the fiscal note, it's a zero fiscal note because this is only applying to funds that have already been allocated. And so as Norm mentioned, the fiscal year 21 and 22 capital budgets appropriated $17 million for fire risk reduction and fuel break activities. With the intent of establishing a proactive annual program to reduce wildfire risk in your communities. So, and that would in turn reduce UGF expenses in the fire suppression component in the future. So, we're basically faced with spending down the $17 million with a combination of all kinds of different things, private companies and our and EFF, and you know, we have lots of different options for spending them, but we can't use the EFF on non-emergency funds. And so, like I said, it's funds that are already, they have already been appropriated, so we're not asking for more. And as Norm mentioned, and I think it was Representative Hopkins that mentioned, we're looking at lots more federal funds coming online. With the infrastructure package that we're seeing even more than last year. So, We know that the state general funds can be used as match to obtain far greater federal awards in the future, making good use of our state funds. I can also speak briefly to how we would fund it in the future after that. I mean, first of all, we'll have federal funds, but there's other ways we can carry over funds into that fuels reduction fund using unobligated general fund balance for that was already slated for the suppression activity component fund. That happened before in FY22. We received $2 million from that. That's kind of, I hope, sums it up, and let me know if you have other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Arians. I believe we had Representative Fields.
Thank you. A couple of questions. First of all, as we've seen very large apocalyptic fires in the Pacific Northwest that tap crews from multiple states, would you say it's a fair statement that if we don't build our own capacity in-state, we face the growing risk that should there be a large fire that threatens a population center in Alaska, and God forbid the timing of that fire coincide with one of the western megafires, we might not be able to get crews from the lower 48, so we would have to be self-reliant. Do you think it's fair to say that as time goes by, the risk of that grows?
Absolutely, but I'd like to let Norm McDonald answer that question.
Mr. McDonald.
Yes, to the chair, Senator Fields. So that is the very concern that I have, that we have. We saw this even last year, which was a fairly moderate season, but was a very busy season in the lower 48, where we requested crews and we were unable to get those. So that is a very real concern, and I'd like to point back to 2019, where we imported 5,200 firefighters from the lower 48 that year, and we were very lucky that was a very slow season in the lower 48, so those resources were available. But if we have a season like 2019 in Alaska, and the lower 48 experiences seasons like 2000 or 21, like they've had, those resources will not be available, and we're going to have some very tough decisions to make on what gets protected and what doesn't.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Follow-up, Representative Field.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to observe that this could be an existential question for some of our communities. If we don't have folks in state, we may not be able to save them. I did have another question. Down the lower 48, the fire season now is approaching year-round. There's a really large fire outside of Denver, California, seeing fires at crazy times of year. And my question is, do you think that with the very long and almost unceasing fire season in the lower 48, some of our crews might be able to go to work down there and actually sustain year-round employment, which would really help with recruitment? Thank you.
Mr. McDonald.
Chair, Representative Fields, currently we do support the lower 48 when we can make those resources available from Alaska, and that's based on hinges on our fire danger being reduced to a level where we can do that. But you're correct. And for example, this year we had resources from Alaska in the lower 48, in particular into California, into November of this year. We've sent firefighters down, right around Christmas to other parts of the country. So you're correct. It's the fire season has turned to a fire year nationally, and in Alaska, our fire season continues to grow on both seasons, spring and fall, starting earlier and ending later. So it's a national problem that we're facing, but there's definitely opportunities for Alaskans to support the national effort, and we do that as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question might be for Ms. Arians, but I'm not sure who's implementing the fire suppression, fire prevention work. Some of the language that we put in and have heard back from the Division of Forestry for the funding of the specifically the fuel breaks went to private contractors to help with the local economy and also ease of work for people who had the equipment on hand and who knew the area and might be able to use some of the fallen wood for themselves or for someone in their community. With utilizing these emergency firefighters during non-emergency firefighting times and tasks, which is what the bill allows, will this take money away and opportunities away from those local contractors that were getting funding through the fire prevention money and fuels mitigation efforts?
I could let Norm speak to this, but I just want to mention that we are going to use everything possible, all the resources possible to address this. So EFFs are just one piece of it. Norm, do you want to speak further to that?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hopkins. So we utilize a variety of different resources to do fuels mitigation. And you're correct, in Fairbanks right now, we do have, especially in our maintenance, we use private contractors and with the dozers and what we call roller choppers. That's the most efficient tool for the job. Where the crews are shine and where they really do their best is when we create what we call shaded fuel breaks, and that's leaving larger, healthier trees and removing the dead and down, the beetle kill type trees that creates those ground fires. So there's places where the right tool for the job is a private contractor with heavy equipment. There's the right place and time for EFF. There's a right place and time where we need really some technical falling to bring in professional fallers and do work there. So there's opportunities and work for all levels of the resources we use, private sector, agency crews, and then EFF if this bill gets passed.
Good news. Thank you, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my question is for Ms. Ahrens, who spoke to the fiscal note and then started to, she said, and when that money's gone, but we didn't, so what, let's presume that we use that 17 to 22 million in a CIP in the next two or three years, and with the scale of Alaska, it does not cut all the fire breaks, and then we have a rainy year, but crews that we want to put to work, how are we going to fund them then?
Through the chair, Representative Cannon, that's a great question. And so, I think I understand by sort of when this specific fuels reduction fund runs out, then what do we do after that?
Yes.
Whether it's rainy or not, doesn't affect you know, wouldn't affect whether we could use the funds for fuels. But what we're anticipating is that, like in the fiscal year 22 budget, where we were that year we got unextended, unobligated general fund balance. We said not to exceed $5 million from the fire suppression activity appropriation. And so we ended up getting $2 million to add to this fuel fund that we could use in the future. So what we're hoping is that we would, first of all, we would still be applying for federal funds to be able to do these fuel breaks. Whether it was rainy or whether it was hot and dry and burning, because those fuel breaks help us in the future, to manage our fires to prepare for them so that they don't affect communities. But this allocation from funds that have already been allocated for fire suppression and then rolling them over into our fuels fund is a way that we could in the future fund more state funds as kind of a way for future proofing this fuels project, the fuel fund. Does that answer your question?
Representative Hannah?
It does to some degree. So my follow-up is leftover money in the fire suppression fund, do you only have that on low fire years? I'm going to presume that 2019, there was no state money left in our fire suppression fund at the end of that hot, burning summer. But maybe last summer there is some money. So how many, and I know it's unpredictable, but how often do you have fire suppression money left over at the end of a field season that can be rolled into the fuels, the fire fuel reduction fund?
Chair, Representative Pannon, thank you for clarifying that. And I'm gonna hand that over to Norm. He has a better idea of the yearly variation in the leftover funds.
Mr. McDonald.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. Yeah, that does vary year to year. So I think that we were looking at several options or opportunities to continue the fuels funding. The use of unspent suppression funds was one. The other portion I'd like to point out is right now fuels and fuels reduction is there's a huge push nationally for that. And there is this year and moving to the future, there will be a lot of federal funds available to support that in every state. Alaska will compete with all the Western states for this type of funding, and we have a staff that is there to do that. So not only the state funds that we do have and we'll use in the future will go to leverage federal funding, which, as I mentioned, there's a lot more of that coming available to states. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. The longevity of this will be a combination of state funds, but also using the state funds to leverage federal funds. And the one important piece to having state funds available is on the maintenance of existing fuels projects or fuels breaks that we've completed over the last 20 years. We cannot use federal dollars for that maintenance. It's the state's responsibility to do that. The maintenance is much cheaper than the initial implementation or development of those projects. So having state funds available to do this maintenance and keeping those fuel breaks viable is a really important piece to that funding. And I hope that answered your question. If not, I can try to clarify.
One more follow-up?
Follow-up for Senator Hannon.
Mr. McDonald, through the chair, if you had a low fire year and you were using all the EFF crews that we've stood up and are now going to be able to employ, how many seasons of fuel reduction work do you think that fund could fund for them? Is that 2 years of work or is that 5 years of work?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I have a difficulty saying that. Right now we have, our EFF crew pool is down to 8. Our intent is to get that built up into that 20 to 25 crew range. I think trying to get back to where we were, as Representative Cronk mentioned, to the 70 or even 50 crews, is probably, that would be a stretch. But if we could use the combination of House Bill 209 and the academy training and some other programs that we have, I feel like a 20 to 25 EFF crew roster is achievable and is the right size for the state of Alaska. So currently with those eight crews, I would have to, you know, I think that really depends on how successful we are at building our crew program in the future. And I would like to say, I don't know if there's a time frame, like if we had 20 crews working, that would be done in 2 years or 3 years. The reality is between fire seasons when we're busy and the slower seasons when we have time to work, you know, obviously those slower seasons we're going to have more accomplished on fuels projects than a season like 2019 where it was all hands on deck all season for wildland fire. I can try to, you know, build an estimate for you and provide that to you, but off the top of my head, I have a really hard time and be able to give like a really clear answer with the question, I guess, the unknown of how many crews we'll have, and then, you know, how much work they would produce. But I guess to go back to this House Bill 209 in combination with some of our other programs is the right step in helping us develop that crew program and having those resources available to produce definitely more than we can right now. So if I can try to come up with a scale for you, like what, you know, what eight crews could produce versus what 20 crews produce, if that would help you.
Through the chairman, Mr. McDonald, please do not spend your time on my esoteric question. I thought if you had contemplated, I would much rather you spend the time developing the academy and recruiting the firefighters.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald and Representative Hannon. Representative Gillum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McDonald, just for my own clarification, you said that, I think you said we can use federal funds for the initial fire break, but then we have to use state funds for the maintenance. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gillum, that's correct. Federal funds cannot be used for maintenance of the fuel breaks that were already started on federal funds. That's the state's responsibility for that maintenance.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the department? All right. We'll now move into our public testimony section of the bill. Please consider public testimony open on House Bill 209. I'd like to ask those testifying to keep their testimony to 2 minutes. Please put your name on the record and notice any affiliation and residency. And we'll begin with Charles Sink online.
Representative, this is Charles Sink. I work for Chigachmute, but I'm also the current chair of the Alaska Wildland Fire Coordinating Group, this policymaking group, this interagency, both state, federal, and Native representative. Chigachmute is a Native nonprofit that maintains a 20-person Type 2 fire crew with a 5-person fuel break crew. I've been working for Chigachmute for 20 years and been integrally involved with trying to maintain the EFF crews around the state, along with the other Native crews in the state. We worked on field breaks such as the Funny River fire that we touched up just before that fire occurred, and we helped develop the Sterling field break down by Swan that was utilized by the Swan Lake fire as protecting the community first. And then allowed the firefighters to build other lines to protect the community. And saying all that, with the EFF firefighting group that's trying to be rekindled, as Norm says, we went from about 70 crews back in the 1990s down to 8 crews now. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of the major things is to when you're developing wildland fire crews and fuel break crews, is the consistency of being able to work. And that, I think that has a lot to do with the village crews falling apart, is that we haven't been able to maintain longer-term employment, and so we've lost that workforce. And the training is key because when you're developing a 20-person fire crew or 22-person fire crew that Norm described, it takes consistency and training hand-in-hand to make that work. And before I go, I'll just touch on, there's a mention about private contractors or what we would call mechanical contractors using machines to help maintain fuel breaks. We ourselves are doing a combination of mechanical work that we hire out privately and having our fire crews do the handwork portion of that work. So it kind of goes hand in hand. It's not an either-or type thing. It doesn't detract from one or the other. And utilizing the funds appropriately to create these fuel breaks. But we've enjoyed a lot of success over the 22 years that Chief Gatchman's been involved in wildland firefighting. And we've trained up a lot of firefighters that now run crews or work in the agencies and participate productively in wildland firefighting in the natural resource field. And we've got a lot of important people in a number of communities around the state, a lot of bush communities. And one thing I found in one of my studies of the workforce development of EFF crews back around 2004 when I was working on this problem, that these really small villages, when they can get a fire crew out, a one deployment of 2 weeks long in a wildland firefighter group out of a community has an impact of 10 to 15% of the total gross revenue for those really small native communities in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sink. Kelsey, can you clarify that there's nobody else online? Anybody in the room looking to testify in regards to this bill? Seeing or hearing none, with no other individuals wishing to testify, we'll now close public testimony on House Bill 209. The plan is to set the bill aside and pick it up again potentially next week. Are there any other closing comments or questions from committee members? Seeing or hearing none, any closing comments from the bill sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciate everybody allowing us to take the time to introduce this bill, and hopefully we get it moved through. But it's a good bill for Alaska and our firefighting. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Crone. Next on the docket, we'll pick up House Bill 52. It was rescheduled from our Monday meeting that we ended up canceling. We'll roll right into amendments. We received one amendment from Representative Shragi, which was posted to the basis and should be in front of you, labeled D1. Representative Shragi, would you like to move your amendment?
Yeah, I move amendment number one.
And I'll object for the purpose of discussion. Representative Shragi, would you please explain your amendment?
Yes, my amendment. Sorry, just looking at some paperwork that's been handed to me. Yes, my amendment. After public testimony and the bill presentation, I have some concern over taking action on this hatchery at this time, given the 10 years that we have to resolve this issue. So what my amendment does is it strikes out the language exempting the hatchery from the park and requests a study from Alaska Department of Fish and Game as well as Natural Resources to look at some of the issues around the hatchery that were outlined during the presentation, ranging from the disposal of fish and the impact on potentially the lagoon there, as well as some of the predatory creatures coming in to eat not only the carcasses, but also many of the other wildlife that exist in that area, as well as I think some of the concerns that we heard about pink salmon and the influx of them in that area and the impact on king runs or otherwise. So it requests a study combining the expertise of Fish and Game as well as Department of Natural Resources, and then also asks for DCCED to take a look at the economic feasibility of that hatchery, given the strong concerns that were outlined by so much of the public testimony over the financial feasibility of that hatchery. So it asks for some more information, given that we do have 10 years before this is this issue really has to be resolved and this all comes to a head. And does adopt the discussed parcels into the park, given that they're already being managed as such, and there seems to be a large degree of public support for that move. And then happy to take questions and talk about that further. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Shrug. I'd like to give the opportunity to the bill sponsor to comment on the amendment. And then after that, we'll roll over to the affected departments to speak on what that means to them. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, this is Representative Sarah Vance of House District 31. And I appreciate the maker of the amendment bringing forth the concerns and speaking for a lot of people from my district who raised these. And these are issues that I've addressed in conversations with practically all the meetings that we've had with the Citizens Advisory Board of Kachemak Bay State Park. As they've mentioned, this has been a longstanding area of contention and concern. But I am in opposition to this amendment because it essentially guts the purpose of the bill, which is to solve the legal land disposal issue. And I am concerned that it would cause either unfunded mandates or adding a fiscal note with requests to specifically fish and game for the research. I do support looking to the future for research in Kachemak Bay and the Teca Bay for the effects of the entire system, because the effects of the salmon is not the only issue there. But that is something that, on a broader perspective of fish and game, that we're needing funding for more research overall. And I'm taking other separate actions to work towards that overall goal. But at this time, with this amendment, I feel it is not going to be fruitful for the purpose of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Mr. Orman, on the line, can you speak to what this amendment does in your eyes?
Representative Puckatuck, this is Christopher Orman, Department of Natural Resources, Assistant Attorney General for the state. I'm going to defer mostly to Monica Alvarez as far as any policy issues or anything along those lines. But legally, just backing up, I think what Representative Vance said, what the amendment would do, it would remove the carve out for the hatchery, if you will. And as a result of that, the hatchery would remain within or on legislatively withdrawn lands. And as a result, the disposal problem would remain. So even though there would be reports and everything else that would be drafted, there would still be a disposal problem. And pursuant to the disposal problem, there'd be legal exposure for the state, meaning the possibility of lawsuits and challenges pursuant to the hatchery and those operations as far as being an unconstitutional disposal. So that to me is kind of the legal issue. I hope that answers that portion or kind of what you were looking for, Representative Puckatuck. And as to the rest, I'll defer to Monica Alvarez with the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. Ms. Alvarez?
Thank you, Chair Puckatuck. My name is Monica Alvarez, for the record. And yes, I concur with Mr. Orman. The disposal problem would still exist and is an exposure for the department. I can provide a little bit more information from our perspective of just kind of clarifying the issue, if you would like that now.
Yes, please, before we go into the fiscal note that may be taken on by the department.
Great. Okay, so DNR supports HB 52 because we see it as the necessary mechanism to address these significant legal problems, the first being the disposal of legislatively withdrawn lands, and the second being the 1978 Interagency Land Management Agreement, which we call an ILMA, that's between the Department of Natural Resources and Fish and Game. You know, as we've previously stated, land disposal law has developed over the last 20 years, and activities that we once thought were permissible are now being analyzed under a different lens. So accepting conditions as they've always been with the hatchery is no longer an option, given the legal challenges the department now faces. The Alaska Supreme Court has made it clear that functionally irrevocable agreements are a disposal of interest, and the functionally irrevocable test set up by the court focuses on the likelihood of revocation instead of a contract's actual language. So an example to further make this point in this instance is that in January of 2021, the Department of Natural Resources was informed by DCCED that Cook Inlet Aquaculture had to continue to operate the hatchery to secure a return on its loans. This is the exact type of financial interest that makes Fish and Game's revocation of its agreement with Cook and the Aquaculture unlikely. The 2016 deed of trust and security assignment of a lease where these legislatively withdrawn lands are used as collateral for a $922,000 loan further establishes the unlikelihood of revocation here, as Fish and Game has assured DCCED that the hatchery operations will continue for that return on a loan. Second, the Isle of May. When the legislature withdrew these lands in 1970, it mandated that the lands be managed solely by DNR. The legislature did not authorize other agencies to manage Ketchikan Bay State Park lands. In 1978, when the Department of Natural Resources issued the Isle of May to Fish and Game, it did so without legislative authorization. So, and additionally, when the legislature adopted various hatchery statutes in 1976 and 1988 under Alaska Statute 1610, the legislature did not include amendments to Ketchikan Bay State Park, enabling legislation, the land and waters being managed by DNR. So returning these lands to the public domain, making them general state lands, provides Fish and Game and the Department of Natural Resources the flexibility to resolve these issues. I'll remind the committee that DNR and Fish and Game submitted a letter of support on HB 52, and both agencies agree that it provides the means for curing these legal issues. If these lands remain legislatively withdrawn, we have way more limited tools to resolve the issues.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarez. Representative Fields, I think the plan was to hear from the other departments that may be affected by the amendment and then have an open discussion on that. Is that okay? Okay. Ms. Alvarez, were you finished?
Yes.
Thank you. Next, who is on the line for DCCED? No. Oh, they're not called in. I believe a copy of an email was passed out in regards to the zero fiscal note that DCCED would have in regards to the amendment. So next we'll go to Mr. Raybung with Fish and Game.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Sam Raybung. I'm the Director of Division of Commercial Fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We own the hatchery in question, and we operate it on state park lands, as Ms. Alvarez said, through an ILMA, which was thought to be proper at the time it was issued, and at the time the state voted on bonds to build this hatchery and invested in it and continued to the point where we contracted out the operation to a private contractor to operate it on the behalf of the state at no cost to the state. So that's where we're at now. We agree with Ms. Alvarez that this amendment does nothing to cure the paperwork issue with the land use. And as Ms. Alvarez also said, our commissioner and DNR's commissioner have both submitted a joint letter in support of HB 52 as written. And I'll stand by for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Raybung, Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I got to say these arguments are nonsensical. So Ms. Alvarez argued we have to leave a hatchery in place to earn money to pay back a loan, but the hatchery is not making money. So we're not going to somehow repay the loan when we're just loaning more money to this hatchery and taking on more financial liability as a state. I don't see how that makes sense. The issue that there's a land disposal problem that's solved here by carving this land out of state park, I also find illogical. So this is a hatchery in state park land, and the park's plan says it's incompatible with the state park. So we can carve it out in a sense that is not solving a problem so much as just changing the use of the land that is in a way that's inconsistent with what we as the legislature did, you know, back when the park was created. So I really have to question the validity of these legal arguments that we've just heard. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Either Mr. Orman or Ms. Alvarez or Mr. Raybung.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fields, through the chair. Yeah, nobody has said that this hatchery doesn't pay its bills. It is viable, and it does pay its bills. It is current on all its loan payments. The contract we have with the operator states explicitly that if we end the contract, and either party can end the contract with, I believe it's 180 days notice, the contractor will be allowed to continue to harvest cost recovery fish until any fish they produce stop returning. So in the case of pink salmon, it's 2 years. In the case of sockeye, it would be 3 or 4 years. That's the only commitment. Ms. Alvarez mentioned a lease agreement. There is no lease agreement, but there is from DCCED is a, I forget the exact term, but it's an assurance that DCC would be allowed to enter the property to recover any collateral assets were the operator to default on its loans. So it's just an assurance that they, I think it's called a deed of trust, but it's an assurance that they have the legal authority to enter the property to recover any assets that are securing the loan. The facility itself and the land it sits on do not secure the loans, and they cannot secure the loans. And DCCED, if they were on the line, could speak to that. We've been around this for decades. I would also add that the legislature not only created the park, but they also created the hatchery. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Raybone. Mr. Orman?
Representative Puckettuck, through the chair, and to kind of address Representative Hopkins' comments. I'm going to defer to Ms. Alvarez about
that. That was Representative Fields, Mr. Orman.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Fields. I apologize. I apologize to the committee. Not taking good enough notes, or I can't read my own hieroglyph. I'll defer to Monica Alvarez as far as the plan. She obviously knows the plan better than me. And she can address the incompatibility issue that was raised. I think the difficulty here in explaining disposal and, you know, the financial success and whatever that may mean for the hatchery is a separate issue. The question of whether there's a disposal here and whether there's a functional or revocable agreement between CIA and ADF&G is relatively clear. That's what those 2016 documents that were provided, the deed of trust and the security assignment, help and establish. Those establish that essentially there is an agreement that's now sitting out there for a loan of $922,500 by CIA that's using state lands because it's a deed of trust, meaning an interest in state lands, in legislatively withdrawn lands, for $922,500 to allow the hatchery to then allow CIA, excuse me, to build capital improvement. So what you have is you have DCCED holding an interest in legislatively withdrawn lands. And those legislatively withdrawn lands, which, by the way, can't be disposed of, is now providing the collateral for that loan. So, but again, under the functional revocable test, a few things, and this is probably my fault and DNR's fault for maybe not explaining this as clearly as possible, is that functional revocable is not about the language in the contract. And it's not even necessarily about maybe the intentions of all the parties or what everybody hopes for. What it's about is, in reality, the agreement that exists between CIA and ADF&G tomorrow, will it be revoked? Is it truly what one would call a revocable at-will agreement, like a permit? And the answer to that question is no. The answer to that question is because of the interest that DCCED holds here, the deed of trust, as to the investments and their interest to ensure that the hatchery continues to operate. And we can even turn then to the language that's within the agreement itself between CIA and ADF&G that allows CIA to receive 180 days notice before they have to leave or before termination of the agreement, that there's actually a portion within the agreement that notes that capital improvement will that they have paid for, that CIA has paid for, that there will be some mechanism for them to be repaid for those capital improvements. So when we start looking at disposal and we start asking those questions, those are the kind of questions that are asked. And so I understand it is confusing because functional revocable is completely, it's kind of seems foreign because it's not necessarily about the contract. It's suddenly about what is the interest and what are the investment interests here, and then what happens with those interests, and does that prevent then the revocation of the agreement? Now, I will finish by saying a few things. Fish and Game clearly disagrees with that analysis. They disagree with DNR, who manages these lands, and that view that there is clearly a revocable problem here with the agreement with CIAA. But in completing the analysis, my job as a lawyer is to determine if there's exposure that exists for the state and the possibility for that exposure to lead to lawsuit exists and needs to be pointed out. And that's what's happened here, is that in the process of reviewing these issues, that the determination has been made that there is a disposal problem. Now, how this body or anyone chooses to cure that disposal problem, that's clearly a policy question. But there is a disposal problem as far as for these legislatively designated lands. And so, I can talk more about this. I can cite the specific language if I need to within either the deed of trust, within the security assignment. For example, the deed of trust allows, it's not just an entry. It allows for DCCED to actually come onto the property to operate the hatchery if necessary for return of that investment. DCCED also, based on the language in that agreement, even is allowed to potentially sublease and sell those lands if necessary to receive a return on that. Now, that's illegal. Maybe that doesn't happen, but the language is there, and it's in a recorded document pursuant to these lands. There's a deed of trust that clouds the title on these lands. So I hope that makes sense. I'll defer to Ms. Alvarez to talk about the language and about compatibility. And nothing further from me. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. Ms. Alvarez?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, just to speak to the incompatibility that was raised regarding the plan. The plan listed the hatchery as incompatible for two reasons. First, it's viewed as incompatible with park purposes listed in the statute. And second, we recognize the disposal of interest issue. And it listed the hatchery as incompatible in a portion of the plan that park staff uses when permitting activities. So we would certainly not want another hatchery permitted in the future. And we recognize that there are issues with this hatchery. That is why the park plan listed the hatchery as incompatible. So it was twofold. And again, that was a recognition of the state disposal case law development over the years and what we have come to know now as compared to in the past with the original state park plan. And I can answer any further questions on that if there are any.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarez. Follow-up, Representative Fields.
Thanks. I appreciate those additional comments. I mean, it seems to me the solution is not get rid of state park land, but shield the state from further exposure. We heard DCCED has exposure, and the right way to remedy that is not to somehow liquidate state park land, but to protect the state from further exposure from a financially risky investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Mr. Orman.
Sorry, Representative Puckatuck. Mr. Orman again. I had my mute button. I seem to be slow on that through Teams here. I don't have anything further to add. I think, as I noted, it ultimately is a policy decision about how to maybe solve the disposal issue here. But there is a disposal problem here. There are legislatively withdrawn lands where hatcheries being operated that's inconsistent with 4121-131. That's Ketchikan Bay State Park, the plan, the enabling statute that establishes the park. And is inconsistent with the case law that started in 2000 pretty much with Northern Alaska Environmental Center, and it's continued with most recently in August 2020 with the SEAC decision. So there is an issue, there is a problem. I'll note for the committee something as far as thinking about this and as far as the hatchery here, and you know, I think it was Representative Hannon a while back, and I know Mr. Raybon has made comments about it in the 1970s. The ILMA was issued, and there really hasn't been a problem. And I will note that there's been a lot of decisions that we've seen that were made in the 1970s, whether it was about university lands, whether it was about mental health trust lands, and we finally realized that maybe wasn't the best option, maybe that wasn't the best decision to make, and that there are legal problems. So these things catch up, and they are discovered, and then there has to be a way to try to figure that out. The second piece that I'll also note, and you know, Ms. Alvarez, I think, wonderfully articulated this, but about the kind of the ILMA thinking about the creation of Kachemak Bay State Park, I'll turn the committee's attention to, if you want to look at a comparison, if you want to look at other potential parks, if you want to look at other possibilities here that have been of where the legislature has said, okay, here's other things that are possible. Here's where in setting aside lands, we're going to allow for other uses. You can look at, for example, the Kachemak Bay State Wilderness Park. When the legislature created Kachemak Bay State Wilderness Park, it included a provision allowing for stream rehabilitation, which again shows that when the legislature is setting aside and creating these kind of lands, in this circumstance with the Kachemak Bay State Park, creating a scenic park, it has the option, it has the ability to mandate how the lands are legislated, how the lands are going to be maintained, and who maintains them, and furthermore, the purposes that they can be used. And so I think in a lot of, you know, to kind of summarize here, the core problem starts with, and I'll agree with, you know, Fish and Game in this regard, the core problem starts with the ILMA, because really there was no authority allowing for the ILMA and allowing for DNR to allow another state agency to manage these lands. And I think it's from there that then all of these other problems, once the hatchery was in place, all of these other problems kind of snowballed from there. I have nothing further. I hope that clarified a few things.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. I guess just to put it a little further, can you qualify in from the legal point of view that HB 52 mitigates the liability for a lawsuit? As written, without the amendment?
Yes. So, Representative Pukatuk, thank you for that clarification. As written, so not addressing Representative Shragi's amendment, as written, what HB 52 would do is it would return these hatchery lands to public domain lands. And as a result of that, that would allow for, it would cure the disposal problem, because with them now being public domain lands, the only issue as far as, quote, disposal in this context, really, then would be public notice. So all of the cases that have been cited that talk about disposal of general state lands, they, if you read them, they all talk about the fact that states failed to provide sufficient public notice prior to the disposal. So the idea would be that if these lands are then removed from the park and become general state lands or public domain lands, then at that point, the only real issue that remains would be the opportunity to provide public notice. All of which is to say, really long-winded, and I apologize for doing it that way, is to say that if these are removed from the park, it allows for the agencies to manage these lands how they ostensibly would want to manage them and remove the exposure that currently exists, because legislatively withdrawn lands cannot be disposed of by the executive branch. So I hope I answered that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. Follow-up, Representative Fields.
Thank you. I understand that kind of narrow perspective on legal issues, but I think the broader legal issue is that the purpose of this bill is to perpetuate a hatchery, which has financial exposure questions for the state itself, and which is sustained by salmon enhancement taxes paid by some 1,100 Cook Inlet fishermen, where Pink's and Cook Inlet are between 1.4% for the drift fleet and 2.1% for the set net fleet of X vessel value. So we have well over 1,000 fishermen paying a significant amount of taxes and receiving almost nothing in return. The number of saners for whom these Pink's are some 45% of X vessel value, there's about 17 saners, let's just call it 24. So you're talking over 1,100 people paying taxes to sustain this hatchery, where a very small number of people get a significant share of plurality of their ex vessel value from the pink fishery. Now, we've also heard testimony from tourism operators who talk about the value of Kachemak Bay in terms of a tourism resource. Pelican Bay is the least developed of the bays. It has some tourism value in that sense. So I think from a maximum benefit perspective in the Constitution, I think we've got a really hard time showing that this bill, which is designed to perpetuate a financially risky hatchery that benefits a tiny number of purse seiners at the expense of well over 1,000 drift and gill netters, not to mention tourism operators and Homer, not to mention the public or at large who has an interest in the state park. I don't know how we can make an argument that we're providing for maximum benefit. That, I think, is the broader legal problem that we have with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Mr. Raybone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out also that the pink salmon produced at Tucker Bay Hatchery are also the cost recovery mechanism that supports the Lower Cook Inlet Lake sockeye program. So Leeser, Hazel, and Kirshner Lakes are all, as well as Tucker Bay Lagoon, are all release sites for those sockeye where commercial and non-commercial common property fisheries occur. Without those pinks paying the bill, that program goes away. And that's a piece of the equation that needs to be on the table. The other thing I would point out is that Cook Inlet Aquaculture's program, they operate, it's an integrated program. So cost recovery that comes from one location is used to fund projects in other locations. So Hidden Lake sockeye on the Kenai River system is one of those projects that produces between 40 and 80,000 sockeye a year for the common property fishery, all users. Also, all the work up in the Mat-Su on pike control, Elodia control, beaver dam notching, flow control, all those type of projects that Cook Inlet Aquaculture does are also paid for with those pink salmon. So it's not as simple as just saying 17 seiners are the only beneficiaries. It's part of a portfolio. And I think Cook Inlet Aquaculture, if you want to investigate Cook Inlet Aquaculture, then you need to talk to Cook Inlet Aquaculture and look at their paperwork, and they post it online, so it's available. But that's not at issue here. What's at issue is Fish and Game's hatchery here. We can get a different operator, but it's still the disposal of land issue. And the one thing that DNR and ADF&G agree on is that the state has invested in this hatchery, and it's been operated both by Fish and Game and by the private sector since the late 70s. And the state bonds built it. And it's only recently come to light that the agreement for the land use is in question. And so that's what this bill remedies. It's not about the hatchery itself. It's about remedying the land use and taking that obligation and, I guess, legal jeopardy for the state and curing it. And the provision within HB 52 that allows the land to revert to parkland if we cease to operate the hatchery and remediate the site, it comes back in the park. So it seems like, from our perspective, a win-win.
Thank you, Mr. Raybone. Representative Fields?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think we just have to differentiate the function of a pink hatchery and the function of collecting sockeye eggs, which are then reared at Trail Lakes. The collection of those eggs is a less facility intense operation. It's, you know, one using a lensing bags and some pumped water. And fortunately, this is not the only hatchery, and most of them do a lot better at cost recovery. So the real question is, if we're going to be collecting eggs for sockeyes at Tucker Bay, what's the most efficient way to do that? What's the lowest risk way to the state? And do we have a pink hatchery to support it? I think that's a very dubious argument financially. Or do we use the other array of hatcheries to be part of that ecosystem? We can absolutely collect sockeye eggs at Tucker Bay Lagoon without a pink hatchery. And to say that you need the pink hatchery to collect sockeye eggs, I think it's just inaccurate. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Vance, if you'd like to add anything to the discussion.
I think Mr. Raybung addressed a lot of the issues of facts, but one thing that I would like to mention again for the record is that the I believe it's 2.8% fisheries enhancement tax is self-imposed by the fishermen. They have an opportunity to vote on that and make changes at their discretion. It is not being imposed upon them. And they do find that this tax and the benefit of hatcheries in the portfolio, as Mr. Raybung mentioned, is beneficial not only to them as commercial fishermen, but to the community. And I've had commercial fishermen tell me that they are glad that they support personal use fisheries for the community to be able to harvest food for their families. This is not just about the hatchery. This is about the entire region and being able to be able to meet everyone in the middle where they are. And I believe that this bill does that, specifically with the reverter language that is conditional upon the continuation of the hatchery, that these lands that are being carved out for the lagoon would go back into the state park. Because as legislators, we have a duty to not only do what is first, what is best for the people, but also for the state, that we have a fiscal responsibility to make sure that we are maintaining the best interest in that regard that benefits the people. And I believe that this piece of legislation does that.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two lines of questions for both DNR and ADF&G. And the first one was regarding Amendment 1 and whether they have fiscal notes from the agency to comply with the report request if this amendment was adopted. And we did not hear from either agency as to whether they have a fiscal note on those.
Mr. Raybung, can you speak in regards to the amendment if it were to go into effect? One, if you would have a fiscal note and any idea what that might be for ADF&G.
Representative Hannon, through the chair. So we haven't done the analysis. The language in the amendment is quite vague, and it would depend on how detailed of a study that we do, but just a ballpark figure, the cost of a fishery biologist and some travel and some of the support would be in the range of $100,000 to $130,000 a year, something along those lines. As you probably know, I mean, our budget has been cut. I've said it in House Fisheries Finance Committee, we've been cut to the bone. We're at the point now where any additional cuts will mean reductions in fishery opportunity. And so if we were going to take on any work, we would definitely need funding to support that. So I'm just ballparking a figure. We'll have to do the analysis. But again, it depends a lot on, you know, what the report means. The language is somewhat vague. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Raybung. Ms. Alvarez, in regards to DNR's burden.
Yes, Representative Hannon, through the chair. Like Mr. Raybung, we have not had the opportunity to do the analysis. I do think that there will be a fiscal note. I just cannot put a figure on it at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarez. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my follow-up is on a different strand, and that is, but back to both of those agencies. Once the awareness about the legal liability about the land disposal that creates that was known, had DNR or Fish and Game identified any nearby properties outside of the existing state park boundaries that would be adequate and for a hatchery? Were there any other land options provided, or was only the carve-out of the existing one the only land resolution that's been pursued?
Ms. Alvarez.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, that there were discussions with the Department of Fish and Game, but in terms of the options available to the Department of Natural Resources, that's not something we look to. I know that Cook Inlet Aquaculture has another hatchery facility that they started up during the time that we were developing the plan in Port Graham, but I understand that there are issues with that one, and that's just something that is kind of beyond the scope of what we were trying to address during the plan process. And I'll defer to Mr. Raybong on in terms of suitable lands for a different hatchery.
Mr. Raybong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So by statute and our guidance, we can't just put a hatchery anywhere. There's very strict guidance on where a hatchery is allowed to be put. So short story long, there are no available locations in the vicinity that would where we could permit a new facility. The Port Graham facility was built by the Port Graham Corporation and was sold to Cook Inlet Aquaculture after they stopped operating it. Well, actually, they bought it. Cook Inlet Aquaculture bought that facility from DCCED, who had repossessed it, basically. And that's on Port Graham land. But it's very limited on water, so it's not a comparison or a compatible. It couldn't pick up the program. And so short story long, no, there are no other locations. This is it. So if this hatchery is, if the land use agreement between DNR and DFG goes away, then this hatchery goes away and that production, the sockeye production in Lower Cook Inlet Lakes, ends.
Thank you, Mr. Raybong. Any follow-up, Representative Hannon? Representative Shragi?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So I guess I'm just a little bit confused by the cost recovery notion of this hatchery. You mentioned that they're current on all their payments, but I'm looking at a profit and loss statement from them, and I see that only two of the last 10 years they actually turn any profit, and those profits are vastly overwhelmed by their losses in the other eight of the 10 years. So can you talk to me about the viability of the hatchery and how that would be used for cost recovery? Is there something I'm not understanding?
Mr. Raybong.
Representative Shragi, through the chair. Yes, again, it comes back to the portfolio effect. They operate many projects, and they have several sources of revenue. The cost recovery from the pinks and the sockeye is one piece. It's also important to note that these are, by law, nonprofits. They're not supposed to turn a profit. Their mission is to provide fish for the common property and pay their own way. So they are in good standing with the DCCED as far as their debt. I think their total combined corporate debt is somewhere around, I'm off the top of my head, I think it's around $14 million, which is, and they make their annual loan payments every year from all of their revenue sources combined. That's all I can speak to that. It's not my purview to manage their operations, but I can say I've spent my career managing these programs. My prior position was the aquaculture section chief, and prior to that I was the PNP program coordinator, private nonprofit hatchery program coordinator for the fish and game. So I understand how they work. And I will say that there is not a single private hatchery organization in the state of Alaska of the 26 hatcheries that operate that doesn't use pinks and or chum as their cost recovery fish to pay for all of their other programs. So sockeye doesn't pay for itself, coho do not pay for themselves, and chinook certainly do not pay for themselves. They are all paid for by pinks and chums, which are the bread and butter fish that pay the bills. And again, they're very, it's an intricate portfolio. And every one of these organizations is a little bit different, but they are all nonprofits, and they are all run by boards of directors made up of the permit holders who voted to tax themselves to operate these. And all of their operations and finances are available, and anybody that wants to go look at them can look at them. And there's nothing nefarious or behind the scenes about them. But back to the topic of this bill, Fish and Game is interested in continuing to operate this hatchery, either by ourselves, if we were to receive an increment, we could operate it ourselves, or at no cost to the state through a PNP contractor. We have 12 hatcheries that we own that are contracted, their operations contracted out to the private sector. in the state. This is just one of them.
Thank you, Mr. Rabel. And follow-up, Representative Shragi.
So I have a little bit of an accounting background, and so I can appreciate there being a portfolio and one company under an umbrella organization subsidizing the efforts and activities of another sub-corporation. I guess I'm confused, though. If this hatchery primarily rears pink salmon, wouldn't it be turning a profit? I guess I'm still confused if we're predominantly producing pink salmon from this hatchery, and that's our cost recovery fish. Wouldn't we expect to turn a profit? And then my second part of that question is, do any of the other hatcheries turn a profit, or would, if I were to look at all the other hatcheries as, under their umbrella, would I see that they're all producing a loss? Thank you.
Mr. Rabel?
Representative Shragi, through the chair. Again, they are all nonprofits, so they can't produce a profit. They can be viable and they can build reserves, but they can't produce a profit. The mechanism, the feedback mechanism, as we call it, is if they start generating more cost recovery than they need, their board of directors is made up of commercial fishermen primarily, but fishermen who would rather catch those fish themselves. And so that's the mechanisms to ensure that, the common property fishery maximizes. On average, statewide, the PMPs contribute roughly 80% of their harvest of their returns to the common property harvest, and the other 20% goes to cost recovery and brood stock. So that's pretty normal and average across all regions of the state. So it's a really good return on investment. And certainly better than when the fish and game operated and we didn't conduct cost recovery. It was just funded by general fund up until that point. So now the mechanism since the late 80s, early 90s, when the statute was passed that allowed us to contract out the operation, we've contracted out the operations, and each one of these facilities has paid its own way. We don't support it anymore. They're not supported by general funds, by any other funds from the state. There is a revolving loan fund that they can access to get them through lean times. And Cook Inlet Aquaculture has gone through some lean times, but they are in good standing on their loan payments. My understanding of the revolving loan fund is that it has generated significant revenue. It's not free money. There's an interest rate applied to it, and the amount that's been paid back has been above what the initial allotment was. So it's generated a lot of money. The revolving loan fund has also been, pieces of it have been carved off and used for other projects, such as the Capstone Aviation project several years ago. So it's been a good return on investment for the state. DCC should actually be online commenting on this, not me. This is their area of expertise, of course. But back to the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association itself, their board of directors, again, made up of permit holders that pay the salmon enhancement tax. It's a voluntary tax that they voted to impose on themselves. They are the board of directors, and they've chosen to continue to operate this program and keep it as a piece of their portfolio. So I guess if you want to dig into their finances, it would be more appropriate to speak to Cook Inlet Aquaculture. But that's not the topic of this bill.
Follow-up, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. I think we have a different understanding of how nonprofits function, but I'm going to leave that to the side for a moment. So let's turn now to the liability that the state carries as a result of this ILMA agreement. Have you guys had – what? Can you maybe put some firmer sideboards on what that exposure is to the state? And have you had an actuary a liability expert provide some sort of input to the state on what that liability is that would maybe justify the urgency behind resolving this disposal issue? With 10 years before this really comes to a head and causes substantial issue, I don't understand why we don't take the time to better understand this fishery, its function within the Kachemak Bay area, as well as the impact on it to the local wildlife and some of the other issues that have been expressed by the citizens of the area. I mean, public testimony has been very divided on this issue, and I'm trying to understand why we don't just hit the brakes a little bit and take the time to understand this issue better. There seems to be a lot of effort behind resolving this today, and that I don't understand. So can you talk to me about the exposure and why that justifies us taking a seemingly very controversial position during this legislature?
Representative Froggy, are you asking of the exposure to Department of Mr. Orman, or are you asking it in regards to Mr. Raybaugh?
Let's go to Mr. Orman.
Mr. Orman, please.
Representative Puckatuck through the chair. Representative Shraga, to answer that question, as far as a number or a dollar amount, no, I don't have that number. I don't have that dollar amount. I'll provide maybe a little bit of history and then talk about the legal exposure just a little bit. So to the best of my knowledge, this concern about a disposal here came to being around 2016, 2017. And it certainly then was mentioned and kind of part of the plan and the plan process for Department of Natural Resources / Division of Mining, Land, and Water. As far as kind of the disposal issue and the exposure, the legal exposure, what I would foresee is that someone would sue about this, about the hatchery, and based on comments, and Monica Alvarez can speak to this, but based on comments that DNR has received, based on comments that I've heard, even during some of the testimony pursuant to this bill, I think the public is well aware of the legal problems here and the exposure. And frankly, with just about everything that I've said here today, I arguably provided a roadmap in some ways for a potential complaint if somebody would want to file that. I mean, I it's pretty clear, and the legal problems are clear. So I think when you talk about the exposure, ultimately it will be, if somebody were to file a lawsuit, would they be potentially successful? I mean, that's my job. That's to look at this and to determine whether or not, that possibility exists. I believe it exists here. I believe that it's that kind of a disposal problem that we have pursuant to this hatchery, and that the problem is twofold. When we talk about the disposal, I'm going to be very clear. I think the Isla May is separate. I think the Isla May and the problem with the Isla May pertains to a potential violation of 4121, 131, and the legislative mandate as far as who's supposed to be managing these lands. When we talk about the disposal, I think that is more specific and pertains to the agreements that exist here, the debts, the loans, the financial interests, and the desire for basically CIA to continue to operate this hatchery to secure a return on those loans, on that debt. I'll note just for the record, they were put into basis recently, the DCCED, the security assignment by ADF&G and the deed of trust that was filed by DCCED. The deed of trust is until 2066. So the understanding would be that CIA would need to, or ostensibly would continue to operate this hatchery in some way to allow for that return on the $922,500 loan that's there to ensure the full return on that. So those are the issues. I know I didn't provide you with kind of the financial fallout or what, that would look like. But I do see pretty strong exposure here for the state. I do see that legal problem. As far as, like I said, I think Monica Alvarez could maybe answer the question of, as far as, what would be the urgency? I mean, other than maybe I hopefully explain that I think that this is a pretty strong legal problem that we have here, and therefore trying to find a solution to resolve that would be best. But beyond that, like I said, I'll defer to Monica Alvarez.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. And just quickly, we talk about the probability of a lawsuit and whether it's attainable to lose the lawsuit from the state side. Would the probability that the hatchery would have to shut down with the success of a lawsuit, where is that probability from your point of view?
Representative Puckatuck, I think that if someone were to file a lawsuit challenging the ILMA and challenging or asserting that there's a disposal of lands here, I think that the necessary result of that potential disposal and of that litigation would be ending hatchery operations. I mean, I think that would be the logical result here. I can't see how that if somebody was successful in suing the state here and presented the arguments, how I think they would be presented, that it would lead anywhere but hatchery operations ending in this location.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. And Ms. Alvarez, before we go to you answering part of that question, following up with the statement from Mr. Orman that hatchery would cease to exist if the lawsuit were successful, armchair lawyering here, can you first provide us with the initial capital cost from the state to open the hatchery? And then, I mean, I'm not expecting to go down the rabbit hole of what each fish is worth in a year that it produces, but it would give a decent understanding of the financial fallout from closing the hatchery. Ms. Alvarez.
Yes, through the chair, I do not have, that would be squarely on Fish and Game shoulders to answer the questions regarding hatchery operations, their costs, et cetera. I can say that, you know, the department supports this bill because it provides a legislative solution to these disposal problems and an alternative to having the hatchery shut down. And I just echo what Mr. Orman had said. I guess I have nothing further regarding that. I don't know the financial impact because DNR isn't in the business of managing hatcheries typically.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarez. Representative Shragi, I know that you had a two-part question. Did Ms. Alvarez, I guess, address whichever part of your question that she needed to?
So, that's sufficient for the moment. I would like to ask one additional question, if I may. Well, actually, it's a little bit of a rabbit trail here.
Yep.
But so you talked about the legal exposure to not curing this land disposal issue. Is there any potential legal exposure of us moving forward with this bill and passing it that we would be sued for for the carve-out? It sounds like from public testimony that this is maybe the second time that we've carved lands out of a park for a use somewhat similar to this, and it sounds like the only prior instance was, I don't remember the testimony exactly, but it sounded like a very different situation. So is there any risk that we would be sued for passing this legislation? Is there any legal risk there?
Mr. Orman.
Representative Puckatuck through the chair. Representative Shragi, That's a great question. As I read the legislation as drafted, so not your amendment, just to be clear, the purpose would be to remove the hatchery and that from Patchogue Bay State Park, and then as a result, those lands would be public domain lands. First, the legislature, because the legislature has the, I'll step back a little bit. Article 8, Section 7. Provides the legislature the authority to set aside lands as special purpose sites. The legislature also has the authority to adjust those boundaries and to determine what the boundaries of the park should look like. So obviously I don't want to step on anybody's toes, hopefully, you know, Ledge Legal's toes or anyone else that you might speak to on this and that might provide advice to obviously the legislature. But looking at it, I believe that this cures the disposal problem, but further, I believe that it's well within the legislature's authority to adjust the boundaries, and that Article 8, Section 7 provides that authority. So I hope that explains it as kind of general as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Orman.
Very helpful. And then I have one last question, if you'd indulge me, and that's just I heard from Mr. Raybung that if the hatchery were to shut down, that the stocking of red salmon or sockeye salmon would cease in the area. Is there anything that how can we say that definitively? From what I understand, as Representative Fields outlined, we can do the collection with a very limited footprint, simply flying someone out there and with rather limited infrastructure required, do the egg take and rear them, I believe it was at Trail Lakes, and then continue to stock the other surrounding areas. So to what would prohibit us from continuing to what would prohibit us from continuing the red production?
Mr. Raybo.
Through the chair, I would say that two things. One, you would still be occupying the land. So there's a pipeline that comes from the creek that that feeds those lensing bags. So you'd have to have somebody on site because the fish are collected and held in the lensing bags for several months until the egg take occurs. And then so you'd either have to bring the facilities in and out, or utilize the existing facility, which is on the land, which is part of the ILMA.
So
that issue remains. The second part of it is what would support it, what would financially support it, and who would do it. Cook Inlet Aquaculture is the only agency or entity permitted to do this work, and they fund it themselves. So if they lose their funding mechanism, how would they continue to do it? I mean, those are the two parts of that question.
Thank you, Mr. Raybung. And I guess it would be safe to say that operating a hatchery, whatever fish you're hatching, is still incompatible with the park land anyway. I mean, that's kind of the whole purpose of the bill here. So any other questions in regards to Amendment D1 from members? Seeing or hearing none, I'll remove my objection for Amendment D1. Is there further objection from members? We've got an objection. Grace, can you please call the roll on Amendment Number 1?
Representative McKay?
Nay.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Cross?
No.
Representative Hawkins?
Yes.
Representative Rauscher?
No.
Representative Cannon?
Yes.
Representative Gillum?
No.
Representative Shraggy?
Yes.
Chair
Petpeta? No.
5 nays, 4 yays.
With a count of 5 nays, 4 yays, Amendment D1 does not pass the committee. That's fine. Going back to the original piece of legislation, what's the will of the committee, Representative Hopkins?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 52, Work Order 32-LS0327-D from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Yeah.
We've got an objection, Representative Fields. Would you like to speak to your objection?
Sure. Just to add a little bit more, Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity to debate this at some length.
Mm-hmm.
I think my concern is somewhat similar to the issues that Representative Shraggy articulated. I think if we're going to be taking land out of a state park, particularly a historic state park, and in the context of our lands management here in Alaska, we need to do that as a last resort if there's no other option, and only if it's clearly compatible with the overwhelming will of the public. So in this case, we had a public process on the park plan, and it was a public process that determined that this particular use was incompatible. For me to second guess that, I personally would have to see pretty overwhelming public opinion from the region. And I think as Representative Shraggy heard, we've heard pretty mixed opinion. I think a little bit more opposition than support, but in any case, very mixed opinion. I have not seen the case made that we can't rear reds, which is the use that most people in the region support, namely the China Poot fishery. I haven't seen it clearly demonstrated that we can't rear reds without rearing pinks here. And I think it's an important question, kind of as you noted, would the egg collection of those reds be more compatible with the safe park plan compared to eggs plus a pink hatchery? So I think we've got a high bar if we're going to be withdrawing those lands. And I do think it's important to look at the resource of the park and the bay writ large, taking into account all uses, not just each type of fishery, but also the other economic benefits in the area. Homer has a ton of tourism. Tucker Bay is an important part of that. When we look at the public comments, we see a lot of local businesses in the tourism industry who are opposed to this legislation because of the economic impacts. And I think that's an important thing to take into consideration. So we do have a long time horizon, as Representative Shraggy noted, and I don't know why we would rush to kind of pick one thing that seems incompatible with the public will as expressed through a state park plan and incompatible with most of the public testimony that we've seen. So for those reasons, I'll be voting no.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Who objected to the motion, Rossi? Further discussion, Representative Hannon?
I didn't.
I objected.
No, thank you. Representative Hannon?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to make some comments. They're similar to Representative Fields. I have grave concerns about us changing the boundaries of this longstanding state park at this juncture. The only precedent for removing lands from a prior created state park was for a gas line easement, anticipating a major economic infusion to Alaska. And since that easement's never had to be exercised, the public's had no loss of use of that land as if it was still part of Denali State Park. This circumstance is entirely different. And, you know, some of our discussions of it are sort of shaded with fish politics, which I really want to separate from the land use. And the problem is presented. There is an exposure and liability, but I don't know that this is a solution that gets us to a place that I am comfortable with regarding that state park. But I'm also want to make sure that it's clear, having hatcheries in Lower Cook Inlet is a significant economic driver. And I'd like to see that pursued of how we could potentially put the capital and of another hatchery in another location. And I don't know that that's been fully explored, except for there wasn't an obvious option. So at this point in time, I'm going to be a no vote on the bill because of the carve out of a state park that I think is a more significant precedent for us to undo, separating out fish politics from the decision that's before us.
Thank you, Representative Hanna. Any other discussion on the objection? Representative Schrage?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Puckettuck. And, I want to be clear with this bill. I don't necessarily oppose the carve-out, and the hatchery very well may be viable and serve the best interest of the state. But I don't know that from the testimony that we've heard, as we've heard this bill and listened to DNR and Fish and Game, I don't know that we've made the case that this meets our constitutional requirement that our lands and waters be managed for the best interest of the people. I think we have 10 years. We've got quite a bit of time to find out more information. I've got, you know, lists and lists of studies that are currently ongoing. In fact, if Fish and Game and DNR, thought that the cost was the prohibitive factor here, I don't know that that means that we should just take action blindly because we can't afford it. I think we should, again, if we have a 10-year horizon, we should take the time to learn more, learn about the impact of this hatchery, learn about the financial viability of it, better understand the interplay between the pink salmon and the cost recovery and their other operations. And I just don't know that we've made a proper case, that we've done our due diligence and made sure that this is truly in the best interest of the people. And I think the public testimony that we've heard really highlights that. You know, we've got pages and pages of what seem to me to be very legitimate concerns over the impact on other wildlife and also just how this impacts the policy of our state. So, I don't want my vote to be interpreted as being against this bill or against the continuing operation of the hatchery or even necessarily carving out this portion of the park for the use of the hatchery. But I do think that this is rushed and that we shouldn't be taking this action at this time. So with that, I am also going to be opposing this bill. Thank you,
Representative Schrage. Any other further discussion on the objection? Seeing or hearing none, Representative Fields, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
With that, Grace, can you please call a roll?
Representative Schrage?
No.
Representative Gillum?
Yes.
Representative Hannon?
No.
Representative Rauscher?
Yes.
Representative Hopkins?
No.
Representative Crump?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative McKay?
Yes.
Chair Puckettuck?
Yes.
5 yeas, 4 nays.
With a vote of 5 yeas, 4 nays, the bill will move from committee. I'd like to put on the record that Ledge Legal has the opportunity and ability to make any conforming or technical changes to the bill. We'll take a brief at ease and have the committee report signed by members. Back on the record, moving on from House Bill 52 on to House Bill 287, we had public testimony on the bill and a debate amongst the committee. Would any members like to make final comments on House Bill 287 before we look to the will of the committee? Seeing or hearing none, Representative Rauscher, would you like to make up a wrap-up comment being the sponsor?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. House Bill 287 is it's an important bill. I believe we need to pay our debts. When we make a promise, we need to keep it. When we have a statute, we need to follow it. And I believe we need to support the state as far as being able to work with our investors, work with those that are trying to decide how they want to work with us in the future, knowing that we're going to keep our promises when we make them. And I think this is will go a long way to doing just that. And I ask you all to vote yes to support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. And what's the will of the committee, Representative Hopkins?
I move House Bill 287, Work Order 32-LS1319/A from committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to the motion by Representative Hopkins? Seeing or hearing none, the bill will move from committee. Please stick around to sign the committee report, and I'll give Ledge Legal the ability to make any conforming or technical changes to the bill. As the report's being passed around, as noted previously, this Friday we will not have a meeting. Following Monday, we will not have a meeting the 21st. Our next meeting will be Wednesday the 23rd at our regularly scheduled time at 1 o'clock. In regards to the topic of the meeting, our office will be publishing a schedule later in the week, and look forward to seeing you all then. We'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record, the meeting is now adjourned at 2:58 p.m.